Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the Tifa Football Podcast. I am John McKenzie and I am usually joined by my good friend and producer Mike Zimmerman, but Mike is not with us today. But that does not mean that we don't have a fantastic episode for you guys today, because today I am joined by the guys from Scouted Football, Stephen Ganavas and Cleo Davis as well. And boy, do we have a lot to talk about, because we're talking all about youth development, how development pathways have changed across the last decades or so, and what clubs are doing better and worse nowadays. So hopefully by the end of the episode, you'll have a much better sense of what to expect from a club youth development pathway. And of course, we couldn't have the boys from Scouted on without catching up on the latest Wonder Kids. And so the very end of this episode, we go through the best players in four different age categories. So make sure you stay right till the end and you'll catch all of that as well. But as always, it's not me that you want to be hearing right now. You want to be hearing the boys from Scouted Football. So let's get right into it. So Stephen, Cleo, great to have you on the show. I'm really excited about this show today because I've got lots of thoughts. Everyone has lots of thoughts about youth football. A part of the reason I wanted to record an episode with you guys is because there was a tweet flying around on Twitter which just read homegrown in scare quotes with a picture of Liverpool's youngsters holding the Carabao Cup. And it showed you the ages at which the players join the club and the clubs they join from, with the implication presumably being that a player isn't properly homegrown unless they're conceived in the centre circle at Anfield. But it got me thinking a lot about the ideas that we have about youth development, what it should look like. And often I think these ideas are based on concepts that were maybe relevant 20, even 30 years ago, but maybe are less so now. So I wanted to spend the first part of this episode talking a little bit about what youth development in the 21st century looks like, why maybe it looks different to how it looked two or three decades ago, and how we can continue to improve development pathways in football going into the future. So I think there's loads for us to get our teeth into today. And I think we should maybe begin with just a really broad question, because I think the broad questions can often be quite revelatory in terms of what we're trying to talk about here. So I'm going to throw this question to both of you. We'll start with you, Stephen. What is the purpose of youth development?
Yeah, I think there's obviously a few different aspects. I think the Liverpool one is a great example that you bring that up, because I think step one is just having a good set of players to supplement your first team. And Liverpool have shown in the last couple of months, especially with the injury crisis, that they had players ready to step up at the level and come in and just play, not maybe necessarily key roles, but fill in where they have to. Some of them, like Connor Bradley, had some previous bits of experience, and all of them, except I think for Dan's, had come in and played a little bit of senior football before, so they'd kind of experienced a little bit before they were properly thrown into the deep end that the Liverpool have seen in the last week or two. So that's step one. The other's a bit more straightforward. It's find the best ones, keep them, like, say, a Trent Alexander-Arnold. When you're ready, cash in and profit on the other ones when they're perhaps not at the level to be consistently playing first team minutes for you, but you can, put them on their way to playing somewhere else. Next is that fans just really like academy players, and I think it's a great way of building that connection between club and locality. So, and then four, which is probably more the Chelsea aspect, is the FFP get out of jail free card, which is your ability to sell them on and cash that, full profit that has become en vogue now to escape the potential penalties from either the Premier League or UEFA. So they're probably the four pillars that I would say.
Yeah, I'll push this across to you, Clu. So if you have anything that you want to say, do add that on to what you're about to say. But I am going to ask as a follow-up almost. Often when you hear people talking about youth development, there is also the human aspect thrown in there as well. So on the one hand, you'll hear coaches saying, we're not just trying to develop the best footballers we can, but also the best version of human people that we can. It's obviously a very easy, cliched way of talking about development, but I guess there is a question to be raised there as well. To what extent should the human element be important in as a sort of catalyst for what it is that academies are trying to do as well? How would you answer that?
I think the broader question differs with different levels, obviously. I think what an academy mm-hmm. purpose is at the elite level is different to what it would be at like Cymru Prem level, for instance, in Welsh football leagues. Mm-hmm. But there's obviously a lot of synergy. There's a lot of commonalities between that as well. I think to go on to that follow-up question, I think being a good person is probably the bedrock of everything. I think as coaches at every single level, at every step, I think you're trying to develop good people as well as good players. I think that's common across the levels, but then obviously it differs then between what an academy at League Two level, say, to a Liverpool. So I think there's a lot of differences, but there's a lot of commonalities as well. But I think the bedrock of everything is if you have a good person, you can then have a good player.
Yeah, and I think this is really interesting because I think there's always that tension between, on the one hand, treating this development process for clubs as a way of essentially developing assets, right? It's taking, to be completely blunt about it, raw materials, developing that raw material to a point at which it's worth more at the end of that process than it was at the beginning of that process, which is a horrendously, you know, capitalistic, corporatistic, it's just a horrendous way really of talking about the development of people, right? And so I guess that puts it in tension a lot of the time with what we talk about when we talk as coaches, which is this is part of a process of human flourishing as well. So yeah, I'll throw this back to you, Cleo. Do you think that is something that has become harder and harder for clubs to do? And do you think that clubs are getting worse and worse at being able to balance it off, you know, the human element against this more sort of treating players as assets?
Definitely. I think the focus has shifted as well in terms of what fans want from their club. I think there's a lot of focus now on transfers, a lot of focus on the outside rather than the inside. So I think clubs have lost their way in that sort of aspect perhaps. But I think we're starting to see it shift back a little bit more now with the spending caps within the Premier League. I think you've seen Liverpool's a great example of how they're using their academy to supplement their first team. City are doing it quite a lot. Obviously, they're not technically homegrown, but they're still academy players that were brought in at 14, 15, 16, and they've developed. They've given a lot of attention to, a lot of investment in. So I think we're starting to see it shift backwards a little bit. But yeah, I think there is that obvious massive contrast in terms of the outcomes of these players.
I did want to talk about this a little bit later, but I think it slots in quite nicely here. So, Stephen, in terms of the best way of being able to protect the human interest aspect here, is regulation necessary? Do we need to have regulation of these clubs to make sure that the players aren't simply being treated as assets in a way that actually can't, in the long run, maybe negatively impact them both as humans, but also, I think, importantly, as players?
Honestly, I think clubs have got better at this. I think the media's played quite an important role really over the last 10 years or so in highlighting some of the really negative impacts of what happens to young players when they fall out of the academy system. And it's probably quite relevant to the higher level Premier League academies where I assume a player in those academies is thinking that they're on the cusp of playing Premier League football, and then one day they're told that no, they're not going to be playing at that club anymore and have to move on, and the effect that can have on a player that, you know, that potential Premier League career has just been taken away from them. So, look, I'm not across exactly what all the different mm-hmm. clubs are doing, but it seems to me just from the outside that a lot of the media attention on this issue has really had an impact in forcing clubs to develop, pathways for players after they leave the academy, mm-hmm. not just, okay, you've left the academy now and you're not our problem anymore and go sort your life out. So I think that's mm-hmm. a positive step. And I think they need to continue to improve in that area because, you know, there's only a small percentage of these players at the end of the day are going to make it as Premier League footballers. There's a vast majority that aren't. And so there needs to be proper pathways for these players, not just for, you know, potential career prospects, but just mental health things as well.
Yeah. And I suppose the thing that we're talking about here underlying all of this is this big shift in professionalization that has taken place in the game of football. And that involves not only the evolution of ideas, so we could talk about strength and conditioning here, we could talk about medical advances, we could talk about tactical advances as well, which are obviously important. But I think the biggest factor probably is the increase in financial power, which is wielded by clubs, which allows them to develop the game in the realm of ideas as well. So, Stephen, to what extent would you agree that this increase in professionalization in the modern game has actually had a negative impact on youth development? Because so much of actually what prompts clubs to make some of these decisions, which are maybe negative with respect to the development of individuals, they are prompted by the fact that there's so much money at stake now that clubs need to try and get things as right as possible. They need to try and get the process as efficient as possible as well.
I could almost go the other way and say that the financialization has been maybe a net positive for youth development. I think that increased professionalism has come in hand with financialization. And I think that's made clubs turn a lot more and focus a lot more on young players as assets that they can help to develop and grow. And that's a way of improving the standing of a club. And you see massively increased investment in academies, more aggressive approaches to recruit young players. And at the moment in the Premier League, amongst the top clubs, it's like an arms race for the best talent across the UK. So finding young players before they become expensive is really key in running a self-sufficient club in this profit and loss FFP era. And then also I think that, the extra money, I think, means that there is a little bit more budget, I guess, within that academy budget to help in what we talked about before in terms of pathways for players out of the game as well if they're not quite going to make the level.
Yeah, and Hugh, I guess one of the knock-on impacts of this high-stakes financial environment that player development now finds itself within is the fact that it's so easy to fall into short-termist mindsets, isn't it? So you guys have watched so much youth football with Scouted across the years now. It's, and you know, you're well over half a decade of experience doing that in a media space, and no doubt watching young players before that as well. How much do you see this? How frustrated have you got when you look back over that period in time and see players who you think, I was really excited about that player, but it feels as though the way that the game has gone has meant that these players have dropped out of the level that they maybe could have been performing at?
Yeah, I think the high stakes nature of it does encourages coaches and clubs to look at that short term. It does get frustrating when you see players that aren't of the level getting opportunities over academy players. I think when you invest so much in these young players from the age of 8, 7, 6 sometimes, and you've got them all the way through the system, and then they finally reach senior level and you're playing a 32-year-old fullback journeyman over him rather than giving a 17, 18-year-old player a chance. I think that's where it gets really frustrating. I think Arsenal's a sort of a decent example now. I think they've got Cedric Suarez just filling a role coming off the bench last night when they're 6-0 up. Why couldn't you give those minutes to someone like Ruel Walters, for example? He's the captain of their under-21 team, of the UEFA Youth League team. He's out of contract in the summer, so they have an incentive to try and give him those minutes to get him to sign a new contract. But again, they use Cedric Suarez over him, who's out of contract himself and has a future beyond this summer. So I think examples like that really frustrate me, just because I think clubs and coaches have this perception that the more experienced player is the better player, but I don't think that's always the case. I think guys like Roy Walters, for example, have to have that experience somewhere. If it's not going to be at Arsenal, it'll be somewhere else. I think clubs do sort of get their priorities wrong in that aspect. I think there's an underlying sense to it. Obviously, it's a high stakes game, but it is frustrating to see that short termism come into play. Definitely,
this is a question that isn't on the running order, but I think maybe feeds into this. Part of the problem here seems to be that the big clubs want the best talent and they want to get the best talent as early as possible, but obviously that causes a misweighting in many young exciting players' development pathways, because they're then thrown into an environment where they aren't going to have easy routes to getting the minutes that are so important to a player's development, the competitive minutes that are so important to a player's development. Now obviously the loan market is an attempt to try and fix that problem, but do you think that a better solution here would be to for bigger clubs to recognize that actually a lot of the development work can be done by teams further down the pyramid, so that that they sort of have a mindset of picking up these players later. Now, obviously, there will be problems further down the pyramid when they're doing a lot of the development work and their players are then getting picked up. But I'm just interested here in terms of like the sort of the role of the grassroots alongside the role of these top academies. And do you think that maybe the way that this pathway works, with lots of players now getting picked up so young, going through the whole academy system at a club where they essentially will not be guaranteed to get any minutes, do you think that attitude is actually the wrong one for you?
To an extent, yes. I think there are good examples of how these young players who drop out of these Category 2, Category 1 academies can bounce back through the non-league. I think Josh Stokes is a great example now at Aldershot in the National League. Last season, he was a step 5 of non-league. I think it was tier 9 with AFC Sudbury. Now he's gone to Aldershot and he's bounced back. He's got to move to Bristol City this summer. So I think there's good examples of how they can bounce back through the grassroots level. Yeah, in terms of picking them up later, I think minutes is the priority. I think for any player to playing football is how you're going to improve as a player. I think that's the basis of everything. As long as they're physically capable of doing it at a senior level, I think that should be the priority. So yeah, minutes. That's what I always come back to. Can you play as much minutes as possible? And if that means bouncing down the leagues a bit quicker, a bit sooner than normal, then you ideally want, I think that's the way you should probably go, because you can bounce straight back up pretty quickly.
Stephen, I'll bring you in on this as well, because it's a really big topic. So do you have any thoughts on the way that the I'm talking obviously in the English game at the moment, it will obviously be different on the continent, but the fact that we are seeing the big clubs hoovering up the talent, and sometimes that feels as though it's a misusing of the pyramid that these clubs have available to them, where they could allow some of these players to develop at clubs further down the pyramid and then pick them up later.
Yeah, well, I guess the problem is that all these big clubs are just crazily competitive against each other. And if you don't get in early and snap up the player, then he's just going to go somewhere else. It almost becomes like incompatible with the system that they're in. But I think really the key is the loan market. And it's for big clubs that have sent their best young players to League One, to the Championship. Broadly, a lot of those loans are hugely successful and have started to launch the careers of some really good players. Like Tammy Abraham is a great example that dropped down to play in the Championship with Bristol City and performed really, really, really well. And that catapulted him to Premier League with Swansea, then in the first team with Chelsea, and now obviously at Roma. But there's many, many more examples exactly like that. So it's a really good level. There's lots of teams in the Championship and in League One that are looking for these loans to pad out their squads, to play important roles in a league that, the financials are becoming murkier and murkier and more difficult to kind of fill out a really competitive squad. And if you can get a really highly talented young player from a top Premier League academy that's on the brink of first team football, then it's kind of a win-win for all.
We've talked about young players not getting minutes because they're having senior players prioritised above them because of the high stakes nature of the Premier League. But there's another flip side to this problem, which is that sometimes clubs can rely too much on youth products. So I've got an example written here on the running order, which is comparing the way that Barcelona views Pedri and Gavi, and now Yamin Lamal, versus the way that Manchester City have managed Phil Foden's minutes over his development. And there was lots of criticism of the way that Man City were using Foden. A lot of people saying, he's throwing away his career for a club that he'll never end up playing for in any senior capacity. And obviously, in hindsight, we're able to look back on that and chuckle a little bit. But I suppose that there is the other problem here, which is that when you throw really talented kids into these elite environments, there can be a tendency for these clubs, and I guess Barcelona being the operative problem here, that because they don't have the ability to play around in the transfer market, they are relying on some of their kids who came through La Masia in order to help them out. And we're seeing the opposite problem with them, which is that they're burning out these kids really early on as well. So yeah, Stephen, any thoughts on that aspect? The example of the way that City have allowed Phil Foden to develop versus the way that Barcelona have used Pedri and Gavi in particular.
Well, yeah, City obviously have been an elite top-level Champions League competing team for a long time now, with incredible amounts of depth and quality in their senior squad. And so Foden's introduction into the first team was always going to be a bit more, you know, a bit slower and more measured. Even though everyone that could see him play from basically under 17 onwards could tell that he was, you know, predestined to be a top elite level player. Obviously Barca's issue is that they are reliant on their academy, but also that their academy has just churned out in the last few years, just stud after stud after stud. And you start with, you know, Gavi. Pedri obviously didn't come through the academy, but they signed him really young and he came through and was amazing straight away. Ansu Fati, and now you've got Lamine Yamal and Pau Kubasi that are, you know, 17, 16 years old, and they're starting like every single game because they are needed and they're also that good. So it's a bit of a dual issue that if they weren't so good straight away, they probably wouldn't be relied upon in such a way. But obviously you can see the effects. Like Pedri is injured again, I think, for another 6 weeks. Fati has had problems now for 2 years or so. Gavi's done his ACL. And so you wonder where this leads with a player like Yamal and a player like Kubasi, who are they're still young, they're still boys. And even though they're ready to play at this level, there are definitely athletic impacts that come with playing against senior bodies when you're still a child. So obviously, I would not recommend the Barcelona approach. I think City probably could have integrated someone like Foden easier. And so perhaps mm-hmm. somewhere a bit more in the middle would be nice. But it's definitely a worry to see the way that Barcelona are perhaps pushing these players into really important first-team roles so soon.
You guys watch a lot of youth football. Do you think that these elite teams are now being much more careful with their introduction of these players?
I think it depends if you have the luxury to do it. I think, obviously, with the example of City and Foden, they had David Silva, Kevin De Bruyne, Bernardo Silva, they're already playing roles. I think with Barca, it's a little bit more difficult when Lamine Yamal is probably the best attacker. Mm. Gavi's come in and he's setting standards in terms of his mentality, in terms of his ability. Pedri as well instantly became one of the best midfielders in the world. So it's difficult to sort of manage that once they're so good, so young. But I think it comes back to physical development. If you have a good physical plan in place for them to really bulk them up and really get them ready to sustain the rigors of elite level football with game every 3 days is, I think that's key. I think that's what clubs like Bayern and Real Madrid tend to do pretty well. But I also think that the case of international football as well, that muddies the waters a bit. I think with Lamine Yamal, I was particularly frustrated because when he initially broke into the Barca team, Spain immediately called him up to the senior level. And I was thinking, is that really necessary? Do you have to take that step straight away with such a large player pool available to you to go play George Roy, for instance? Obviously, he's of the level, he's good enough, he's a starter, but does he have to be that for Spain? Do you have to give that extra load of matches onto a really young, developing body? I think that's where clubs and confederations and national teams can be a bit more streamlined, be a bit more cohesive together in terms of protecting those players.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
It's interesting that you mentioned physicality, because there's an extent to which, you know, the increasing physicality that is required of footballers in the present day is actually why these players, young players, are getting actually more exposure. So Liverpool, a great example of that, right? A team who play a really intense brand of football, have seen a lot of injuries in their senior squad. And as a result, I was looking at some of the data for Liverpool across the last 4 years. And already with, you know, another 21 possible games for them to go this season, they've surpassed the number of minutes that they gave to under 21s this season. On the last 4 years. So there's an extent to which I suppose it goes both ways with the physicality things. But yeah, let's move on and talk a little bit about one of the pillars that you talked about, Stephen, when you introed this, when you talked about the FFP reality, which is, and to summarize that, you know, this idea of because of financial fair play and the fact that when you bring youth players through your systems, you aren't actually having to book a loss for those players in terms of a transfer fee for them. What you can actually do is just book the sale as a complete profit. So a lot of these teams are using the sale of youth players as a way of being able to balance their books when the FFP window's coming around again. So obviously that's had a big impact in the career trajectory of some of these young players, because for many of the clubs that they have that they're at, they have more value as an asset which can generate quick profit for them than in terms of a long term outlook from what they could get from those players as assets. So yeah, Stephen, what's your take on this, and do you think that this is a negative thing for the game, or is it just, again, one of these, the realities of modern football that youth development sort of has to take into account rather than respond to?
Yeah, again, I think there's probably positives and negatives. I think firstly is it's encouraging the movement of young players to different clubs. And I think generally player movement is going to bring opportunities. I think a really good example of this is Dominic Solanke first moving to Liverpool, although that was on a free transfer, if I remember correctly. But then he's moved to Bournemouth, which springboarded his career. Someone like Cole Palmer's benefited from it this season. I think City, if they weren't going to book such a massive profit, they probably maybe would have thought twice about selling him and just thought, oh, he could be a nice squad player to have this season just to get us through as a backup. But they saw the offer that Chelsea were ready to send their way, and they thought, okay, it's time to part ways and take the money. And then on the flip side, you have perhaps the accumulation of young players in the hope of a future profit, and that's where what we're really kind of seeing with Chelsea right now. Perhaps not so much with the academy players that they've developed for a long time, but maybe more so with the young signings that they've made, guys like Andre Santos and Cesar de Casade as well. And so those things can turn out a bit more difficult. But it all depends on a case-by-case basis. What happens with loans? What happens with their development during that sequence? For example, you've got someone like Santos, who's had a horror run of loans, first with Forest, and I don't think things are going exceptionally well at Strasbourg in Ligue 1. But then on the flip side, with this accumulation, you've got someone like Petrovic who's come in and become the first choice goalkeeper. So there's two sides to every coin. Mm-hmm. I think there's the accumulation thing can be a bit dodgy because obviously you only have 20, 25 spots in your senior squad, and if you're signing all these players, there's never going to be space for all of them. And so then you end up with some guys that end up stuck on loans, and they're on loan every season. They come back, they go out on loan again, and their career kind of wastes away. So there's a couple of different aspects to it. But I think overall, it's a positive.
I want to talk about another aspect of the professionalism or professionalization that we're talking about in the modern game, which has led to, you know, clubs having to be super efficient and try and get the most out of their assets. And I think whenever we talk about youth development, there's always... there's often the criticism that because of this need for efficiency, we see a lot of young players being fit into an academy system, which is now increasingly looking like a reflection of what's going on in the first team, with the idea that what they're trying to do is develop young players who can play the systems that the senior squad are playing. And in theory, then the move from the younger levels up into the senior squad should be more obvious from a tactical point of view, and you should get upside from that. Now, obviously, that's played out against the background of everything we've just talked about there, which is that, you know, it's, you know, the development pathway is such an ephemeral thing that youth players will often end up in completely different clubs, and so maybe you lose a little bit of that upside. But I suppose the other question or criticism often arises out of this is that, you know, young players get pigeonholed too early in their careers, their creativity is being curtailed, and various FAs around the world are producing cut and paste footballers where, you know, depending on what the FA wants from their national team, you then start seeing all of these players coming through, showing all of the skills and attributes that the FA want rather than maybe the skills that they had to start off with. So, Hugh, do you think that you see a lot of this in youth football? Do you think that players are being fit into tactical systems too readily now? And do you think that has a negative impact on a player's own development?
Absolutely. I think the reality of it is, for say your average youth team at an elite level team, an elite level club, you're probably only developing 10%, possibly 5% of those players for the senior team. So to pigeonhole them within that system, within that very specific system, you're not really serving the best interests of the players for the future. I think we're seeing it more and more now at academy level at these elite teams. I think there's a couple of examples in the Premier League that their youth teams play a very certain way with a very certain specific build-up that's only applicable to maybe, 1% of clubs ever anywhere. So by the time they're 24, 25, when they're dropping down the levels to play at League Two, National League level, is that sort of the development that is good for them? Are you developing good players, or are you just developing good role players for like very specific systems? So I think we're seeing that more and more. I think that's really frustrating, because you're not developing the player, you're developing a sort of system player within a system that is only applicable to 2% of clubs anyway. So I think you're failing players there in that aspect. And I think we're starting to see it a bit more and more, especially with certain tactical trends, how teams build up now with the very specific, like the Brighton style double pivot dropping in, like those little set passes. I think that's becoming more and more prevalent at youth level, and I'm not sure it's a good trend.
Yeah, and I guess even just taking someone like Moises Caicedo, who, you know, arrived at Brighton a little bit older, but again, really shone in their system, and that system worked for him. But then when he's been put into the Chelsea system, both in and out of possession, big differences between Brighton and Chelsea, and you can see the impact that has on people's opinions of Moises Caicedo, for better or for worse, regardless of whether or not those opinions are well-founded. It can go to show just how important a system can be in terms of the perception of what a player is like. And so obviously putting young players through those kind of systems will bias people towards maybe things that tactical realities which maybe don't suit them, and they can end up in the wrong system as well. But Stephen, I'll go to you on this. What's the solution to any of this? Because I mentioned earlier on this sort of concept of regulation, but as you correctly pointed out, push back, as you said, you know, there's always going to be someone else finding ways around the system in order to mean that any sort of regulation probably doesn't work. But is it just a case that clubs need to recognise that there are better ways of developing players, and if they overhaul their player development pathways, then it may encourage other teams to do the same thing, so there will be much better, well-rounded players coming through the system in the long run?
Well, I think it's a tough one, because you need to teach players how to absorb tactical information during the academy process. You can't just throw them into, you know, a De Zerbi, you know, training session in pre-season and instantly be able to know all these concepts and be ready to ingratiate yourself into the first team. So I think it's difficult in that sense. I think it's very extreme at the elite level club academies. Think about your Man Cities, or even your Salzburg or Leipzigs, that have a very set style in the first team and it flows all the way through the club. I'm not sure there's a huge number of clubs that are exactly the same way all the way down. I guess a lot of Spanish teams, and this probably goes to a more national influence in the Spanish sense, in that, you know, there's a fairly set defined way that they develop their players at academy level. But I just, I don't know how you escape this, because you need to develop rounded players, and that's not just technically, but you need them to be able to adapt to different tactical scenarios. But then you're also, in a club sense, as you said, you want to develop players that will play in your first team, not another team's first team. So there's a lot of different things, little things pulling at each other that make it difficult.
Yeah, and I suppose underpinning all of this is the age-old adage of, you know, development isn't linear, which means that we should introduce aspects to our player development pathways that allow for this lack of linearity. I guess the question here, Leo, is to what extent do we see modern development pathways allowing non-linear development? Because it seems to me that so much of the time, these player development pathways are really uncompromising. And it's like, if you don't fit in to this pathway, you fall by the wayside, and that's fine because we're still getting enough good players coming out of the other end. Is that just the reality of any, you know, modern developmental pathway? Or is there things that we could do better here?
I think that's true to a certain extent. I think obviously it differs from case to case. I think ultimately players will find a way. I think the good players will find a way eventually. There's a lot of different obstacles that are different to everyone. There is no pathway that's the same. So I think judging players by those predefined sort of, you have to be here now, et cetera, I think that's probably not the best way to do it. Well, it's definitely not the best way to do it. But yeah, I think ultimately players will find a way to push through. However, I think we sort of just to tie back into everything, I think we sort of have to just realign what our sense of a good academy system is. Is it just to develop top players every single year on year? Or are you developing well-rounded players that can go on and have good careers elsewhere? I think that's the broader scheme behind all of this. And I think there's too much focus on getting the Sakas and the Trents and the Fodens every single year after year, relentlessly. That's not going to happen. Those are sort of the bonus players. The players you're looking to have are those well-rounded squad fillers that can go on to have good careers, perhaps at your club, perhaps somewhere else. I think that's the reality that we should be working within, and not over-egging our expectations. I think we need to sort of realign how we think about academy football in that way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and this is starting to move into the realm of, I suppose nature nurture would be the cliched way of putting that, because there are things like relative age effects and early maturation, and these biases are going to obviously impact the way that academies deal with certain players. If you see a player who is physically developed for their age group at the age of 8, you are going to fall into the trap of thinking that player is going to be better overall, but as development isn't linear, you need to take into account the fact that you maybe need to have a longer term view of where a player could maybe end up at. Again, this is coming back to this concept of like how do you balance off the short termist nature of modern football, where you want to get the most efficient route right now, with the longer term issues, of which is, you know, in the long run, you want to make sure that you do end up with players who aren't just burning out too early or missing players in development phases because of simply arbitrary things like that, you know, they were born at the wrong time of the year and so they developed through school at a younger age to some of their fellow students within the same year, and that kind of thing has an effect as well. So, Stephen, how do you think that you prevent these issues from becoming too dominant within youth development? And presumably, clubs now in a much better place to be able to avoid some of these problems.
Yeah, I think as a general rule, clubs are getting a bit better at focusing on qualities that they think will shine at senior level rather than just what looks good right now. So, for example, you know, there might be a striker that's scoring a bunch of goals at youth level because he's bigger and he's stronger and he's faster than everyone else, or he's playing in a really, really good team that's dominating and winning by 5 goals every week. But when that player arrives at senior level, he might just not be ready, and in comparison to senior players that are bigger and faster and stronger than the players that they were playing against at youth level, they might just not be as effective. So I think overall the focus is bending a bit more towards developing really good technical players first and foremost. I even think you're seeing that now with the kind of strikers that are coming through. If you think about someone maybe like Rasmus Højlund, who, yes, he's athletic and he's big and he's fast, but he's also got quite a lot of layers to his game in terms of what he can do a little bit deeper and connecting with others. Someone like Joshua Zirkzee as well at Bologna, similar mold. And I think that these guys compare quite well to the kind of strikers that were really good at youth level, even like 7 or 8 years ago, thinking back to some of the strikers that were dominant at under 17 World Cups, for example, close to a decade ago. But at the end of the day, I think like every club's unique. I think a lot of clubs are more aware of these effects as well. So they'll probably be doing their own analyses within their own academies of these kind of effects and how they can nurture the development of players at different kind of, you know, growth cycles or, you know, athletic levels. So yeah, I think that it's a twofold thing. And I think that the being less reliant on those athletic traits as a centerpiece of the academy at a young age is really, really important.
I do want us to start moving on to talk about some players. You know, that's the exciting thing, talking about some of the talents that you guys have seen at various age groups. But before we do that, let's just try and start tying up some of the loose ends of what we're talking about. And I suppose one of the criticisms you could maybe throw at any sort of criticism of a developmental pathway, so take England, for example, at this point in time, it'd be very easy to angle criticism towards the way that English teams develop their players. And I'm sure there must be better ways of being able to do it than are currently done. But there's an elephant in the room here, because it's very hard to look at the England national team and argue that English football has a developmental problem on the basis of some of the players that are coming through. So I wonder what you would both think to this sense then that we shouldn't really be suggesting that there's a one-size-fits-all approach to youth development. There's no right way to develop players. And so maybe the best way of actually arriving at a system which works for you is to simply find the aspects of a system that are working and celebrate those aspects and improve those aspects. And if you do that, at the end of the day, those good players, as you said before, will rise to the surface. So, Cleo, how would you talk about that? Is it the case that England has a good developmental pathway? Because if we actually look at the players who are coming through, it is working. So rather than starting at the beginning and say, how should we develop this pathway, we should say, well, the pathway is working, let's have a look at that pathway and then try and remove some of the things that we think are standing in the way of some players getting through.
I think you're correct in saying that there's no right way to develop a player. I think every player is different, every club's different, every nation's different. They all have their uniqueness, different pathways. I think one of the strengths of English football is just the depth of talent and culture and history in terms of the league system. I think that's massive. You can see, just like look at the non-league system within English football. I think that's something to be celebrated. I think that's something that's unique to England as well. And that can help develop players. I think there's so many opportunities within English football for these young players to develop, but I think it's just about taking those opportunities, being braver. I think that's what we've seen with this English generation now, is they're much braver than perhaps the previous generations. I think back around 2016, when that first wave of English talent started to move abroad, looking for opportunities with Jadon Sancho, Chris Willock, I think that's what we're seeing more and more of now. And I think that's where English football has really benefited from, in terms of getting new ideas, taking those opportunities that are there for them. I think being brave within that system is what's helped kick England onto where they are now. As I say, I think there's no right way to develop a player. I think everything's different. Everything's pretty unique. I think there probably is like a framework that you should probably work to as a club, as a nation, that really can help mold players into what you want.
I feel hyper aware of the fact that I've asked a question about English football to a Welshman and an Australian. So I do want to give you the chance to talk a little bit about your expertise in your case of a smaller nation looking to develop players. What would your takeaways be from the way that Welsh players are able to develop and work their way into the highest level?
I think in terms of Wales, we're fairly unique in that our league system, or our club system, academy system, is quite interlinked with the English system. So a lot of the best players within Wales move over the border to, say, Liverpool, Everton, Aston Villa, Birmingham, Bristol City, even further afield. So I think we're a bit more unique in that aspect. We're quite interlinked. I think a lot of these issues that we're talking about here are relevant to the Welsh game. I think if you look at the Cymru Premier, the issues, say, at Chelsea are relevant to teams in that level. So I think on the whole, I think teams just need to be a bit more embracing of what they have within their own system, rather than looking outwards constantly. Because a lot of the time, those players that you're bringing from outside the club aren't as good as the players that you already have within the club. So I think trusting in your own is something that we're pretty big on at Scouted. I think this season especially, I think we're starting to see it a bit more in, at elite level, I think. But yeah, just trust in your own because they're good enough. Most of the time they are good enough, but they just need that opportunity. They need that trust from the coach, from the club to say, yeah, you're my guy. We're going to invest some even more time into you to integrate you into the first team. And I think that's what Welsh football at domestic level, which isn't of the highest level, obviously, but I think that's where if Welsh football wants to improve, that's where they can really focus on.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Stephen, I'm interested to hear your thoughts as well on the way that modern academies work. Do you think that there is a lot of space for improvement now in the modern academy space to make sure that they're getting player development pathways, I guess, more efficient?
Probably not, unless they're going to start recruiting players out of the womb instead of at 6 years old. I think, well, in countries like, you know, Spain and England, everything is really, really highly formalized now at quite a young age. So the only real ways of improving is just fine-tuning your processes through the academy from age 6 or 7, whenever clubs are taking their first intakes, all the way through to senior level. It's an interesting contrast though, in that, you know, there's heaps of countries without really formal academy systems that are still able to churn out lots of top level players. So there's a million ways to skin a cat. What we're seeing with Right to Dream, for example, in Ghana, I think their first intakes might be at 11. And they are sending over bucket loads of talent to Europe, even though, you know, these players haven't been recruited at the age of 6. They're hitting a formal academy set up much later. So there's a million ways to do it. I don't think there's a right way or a wrong way. But always you should be trying to fine tune your processes once you have someone into an elite academy set up at a young age.
So I'm going to end this section now with one question to both of you. I'll ask it to you, Stephen, first. What state is youth development in the 21st century? How would you answer that question?
I think everything is just generally becoming more streamlined. The top level clubs are getting crazily aggressive at trying to hoover up young talent at an early age as possible. You're seeing, you know, transfer rumors coming out of 5-6 clubs going to war over the signing of a 15-16 year old from a smaller club somewhere in Europe. So it's getting crazily competitive. But also just, I think youth football in general is just becoming more accessible. You're seeing the UEFA Youth League continue to grow year on year. More focus from clubs is going towards scouting those competitions, youth international tournaments, even though they always scouted them. I think more emphasis in really looking to sign players from those tournaments, and especially from Africa and South America. So I think, yeah, we're just heading in that direction where it's just the process of trying to sign players as young as possible to get in first, get players before they're worth 100 million euros, get them when they're worth 1 or 2 million euros. And I guess, again, that ties into the financialization of the game and clubs trying to find ways to be more financially sustainable. So obviously recruitment plays a huge role in that. Mm. Just in terms of pure development, I think the technical level of players, just you can't imagine, you know, the strides that we've taken in the last 20 years, and it continues to improve year on year, and the level of player that is being produced in order to kind of, I guess, counteract the increased level of pressing in the European game. And you're the tactical expert here, but obviously you can see that the effect of really sustained pressing systems has changed the game massively in the last even 10 years. And you need to be able to develop players that can start to counteract that. And that's where you get your William Salibas and players like that that are able to play out of that pressure and really and those players become super, super valuable. They're basically unicorns that every club is looking to sign. So there's so many little tiny things that come out that are always in relation to what's happening in the senior game. And it's always evolving, always changing. And it's just really interesting.
So what state is youth development in the 21st century for you?
A changing state. I think it's always in a changing state. There's new trends, there's new tactics that always pop up, that always shift how players are developed. I think just looking at the elite level, I think it's interesting to see how this trend now that has been set by Manchester City and Liverpool this season in terms of padding out their squads with younger players from academy level. I'm interested to see how that trickles down, or if it does trickle down at all, because I think it moved a lot to the other way. So if it can move back that way again, to trusting in your own, to have the likes of Bobby Clark and so on coming through at Liverpool and playing pretty important roles within seasons, I'm really interested to see if that does flesh out over the broader spectrum.
Well, let's move on quickly and talk about some of the exciting players coming through right now, because you two both work for Scouted Football, which is a media operation which focuses on the up-and-coming players in world football. So I thought I would make the most of having your expertise on here, help people with their football manager saves or their whatever they do with FIFA. I'm betraying how much of a boomer I am right now. But what I thought we would do is go quick-fire through some age categories and give you both the opportunity to talk about one player within those categories that you're excited about right now. So here we'll start with you. We're going to start with under 17 players. And obviously under 17 players are going to be the ones who are least known about. So you have carte blanche to give us a really exciting talent coming through in the under 17 category right now.
Well, I have actually only picked one player because I'm on the spot a bit as well. So I've gone for Pau Cubarsí from Barcelona. I think we've watched a lot of him recently in youth tournaments at club level and international level. And I think he's just an absolute bona fide, not quite a sure thing, but pretty much a sure thing for the future. I think if you look at his skill set, if you look at his physical makeup, I think he's got pretty much the perfect skill set for the way Barca play and the way elite football is trending. So I think Pau Cubarsí, he's already in the first team at Barcelona, so he's not quite an uncut gem, but I think he's probably one of my favourite up and coming players from that generation.
And what position is he playing?
Centre back. So he's pretty much what you want from a centre back. His detail on the ball is incredible for his age. I think he's a really intelligent defender. There's aspects he can improve, obviously, but I think for what he is now and for what he could be, he could be pretty dominant at this level for 15 or so years.
Stephen, what about yourself?
Yeah, for anyone that's watched the under 17 World Cup last year, you might be familiar with him, but I've gone with Hamidou Makalou from Mali, who is a very, very, very fun, destructive, technical, creative midfielder. He's been linked quite closely with Red Bull Salzburg, who have quite a developed pathway through Mali towards their academy. But he is super, super fun, really energetic, but on the ball also brings so much quality, can run for days. I think he's got a massive, massive ceiling, and I'd be really interested with that with that Red Bull pathway that's been pretty successful in bringing over academy products from Africa, what they'd be able to mold someone like him into.
Now, we're quite safe with under 17 players, I think, because it's going to be 5 years before we can definitively say whether or not you're right or wrong about them. But under 19 players, getting a little bit more risk involved for you guys now. So, Stephen, who have you got for your under 19 player that you're most excited about right now?
Yes, I've gone for Stefanos Tsimas from PAOK in Greece, a young striker. Saw him at the under 19 Euros last year, playing a couple of years up above his age group. He is, you know, I wrote a piece a few months ago about Project Nines and about clubs looking at young strikers that seem to fit the mold of what senior teams are looking for in the top level strikers. You think your Victor Osimhen's, your Hoylands, that kind of player. And I think he really fits that mold in terms of the athletic potential and then all the things that you want of a striker in the penalty box in terms of box presence. Getting in the right spots at the right time. He's played a few games for PAOK now off the bench. I think a couple of starts as well. Scored a couple of goals. Looks the business. So we'll look to see him hopefully get a few more senior opportunities over the next 12 to 18 months or so.
Both of the players you've named so far, you said you noticed them playing in international tournaments. So is that one way that you guys come across these players? Is that one of the main ways that you come across these players?
Yeah, definitely youth international tournaments, UEFA Youth League is probably the gateway. You're generally getting the highest, the cream of the crop, I guess, of these generations of young players. I guess it kind of culls a few out that you might miss from some of the teams that might not qualify. And that's where, I guess, the UEFA Youth League comes in, where you can start mm-hmm. to then see the elite clubs from those countries and then the players within those systems become aware to you. Those competitions definitely are something we keep a very, very close eye on.
Hugh, who's your under-19 player?
I've gone with Tigo Land of PSV Eindhoven. He's at the younger end of this age bracket, but I think he's just starting to break into the PSV first team now. They're obviously steamrolling Eredivisie, so they have a bit of leeway now in terms of the end of the season to integrate him in. Joey Veerman is probably going to leave in the summer as well, so he's a big player for them, and that leaves a hole that Tigo Lang can fill. He's, I was reticent to say it on the Twitter the other day, but he does have a lot of similarities to Frenkie de Jong. So in the way that he plays in midfield, the way that he carries the ball through traffic, through pressure, the way he can slip past pressure, and that little burst of pace that he has over 5 yards is really eye-catching. And I think in terms of his development, the next year, 2-3 years is pretty important in terms of how he can fill out physically. If he does get that little physical edge, I think he can go on to be a really good player at a really high level.
Interesting that you mentioned the Eredivisie here. Do you have more faith that some of these youth prospects will develop in a league like the Eredivisie, because there is much more scope for younger players to be included in squads?
Yeah, I think obviously that the physical level isn't quite as demanding, obviously. So the more technical players can play at a younger age and really build up that physicality within the league. I think we didn't touch on it as well, but within the Dutch and Belgian systems, actually, there's the B teams are playing senior football in the second divisions. So I think these players already come in with a bit of experience of playing against fully grown men at that level. So I think that's a definite advantage for them. I'm not sure it's healthy for the overall, well, it's definitely not healthy for the overall football landscape, I don't think. But I think in terms of play development, it definitely helps. And I think we're seeing it with Tigo Land at PSV.
So under 21s players. So we're now entering a realm that I think a lot of people will have a much better idea about. We'll start again with Hugh. So who's your under 21 player?
João Neves. Or Neves, or however you want to say it, from SL Benfica. I think he's probably my favourite young player at the moment in terms of just his overall skill set. He's an absolute warrior, but he's also this do-it-all midfielder that can do pretty much everything. He's only 5'8", I think, but he wins headers like there's no tomorrow. A lot of teams try and pinpoint him because he's quite small in terms of goal kicks. They drop the goal kicks on his head, but he just booms them back, straight back. So that's something I love about him, but he has that overall ability on the ball as well to be that line-breaking passer, the big switcher. He has a good strike off either foot. I think he is pretty much in terms of what you're looking for in midfield at the elite level, that do it all, press resistant, multifaceted, multi-threat number eight. I think he's the next big thing, and Benfica will make a lot of money.
Under 21s player for you, Stephen?
Yeah, you weren't going to get me on the podcast without mentioning it one, at least one Juventus player. So I'm going to go with Dean Huijsen, young Dutch centre-back that Juventus signed from Malaga a couple of years ago. He's on loan at Roma at the moment for his first real foray into proper senior football. Some of you may have seen the goal he scored a week or two ago, strolling from the halfway line at the, you know, in his centre-back post, rolling all the way through midfield and then smacking one on his left foot from outside the box. He's just the unicorn archetype of what teams are looking for in a centre back. Can play on both sides of his body. He's really tall. He can move. He can withstand pressure. He can carry the ball. He's just what everyone's looking for. So yeah, Juventus have a good one on their hands with him. He's doing quite well and playing some solid minutes on loan with Roma at the moment. And I think Juventus will be looking to integrate him into the first team next season.
As you say, it's inevitable that you're going to mention Juventus, but interesting that they've got so many good youth players coming through, and also that they are loaning out good youth players as well, because Matthias Süle has been on loan as well this season. Is it the case that Juventus have got a really good youth pathway?
Yeah, I wrote a big piece on this on our Substack a couple of weeks ago. But yeah, Juventus have been putting a huge amount of resources into building up what was previously a basically non-existent youth academy into probably one of the best in Europe. Really aggressive recruitment all over the world in trying to build an academy that can produce players for the first team. And it's, you know, upwards of a dozen now players through the next gen team, which plays in the third division in Italy, have come through and played senior football. And it looks like at the moment there's a really good crop. At the moment there's Kenan Yildiz has come in and played important role in the senior team this season, Fabio Miretti as well. So yeah, starting to see the fruits of you know, just under a decade of some pretty big investment into the academy side of things.
Let's move on to our final category, which is under 23s player. And I'm guessing that most of these players will, in this category, will be playing for senior clubs right now and will be there and thereabouts breaking in. So Stephen, we'll start with you. Who's your under 23 player that you're most excited about at the moment?
Yeah, this is one that I'm always intrigued, doesn't really seem to get any hype, and that is Alex Baena from Villarreal, who has played two solid seasons of senior football now with Villarreal, can play in a range of different positions, can do a bit of everything, super decisive final third player. I was writing a profile on Lamine Yamal the other day and looking through the data, and every single thing that I was searching up was Alex Baena up the top, Alex Baena near the top. So yeah, he's just super energetic, super athletic, decisive in the penalty area, bobs up with goals, bobs up with assists, really good passer of the ball. So yeah, I think he will be one, perhaps at the end of the season, I think that the noise starts to rise a bit in terms of a move to a bigger club.
And finally, Hugh, who have you got as your under 23s prospect?
I've gone with a player that you'll all be familiar with, yourself particularly, John. I've gone with Nico Williams of Athletic Club. I think in terms of emerging talent, that sort of next level of superstar, I think he could be the one that could make that jump. I think he's getting to that age now where he could make the leap from a good player at Athletic who are competing for Champions League this season into a really, really good player at a top team. So I'm interested to see how he develops over the next 12 to 18 months, 24 months. But yeah, exciting. I think it's just his skill set is exciting. Two-footed dribbler, gets in the box. Just, yeah.
Yes, well, I'm quite pleased because I managed to make it through all of these players without making a joke about Huijsen having sauce. But we made it. We've got to the end of the episode. I could carry on talking to you guys for another hour or two. But unfortunately, logic dictates that we have to end the podcast at this point. Thank you both so much for coming on. I said at one point in this episode that you are both working for Scouted Football. Stephen, would you like to just give a little bit of a sense to our listeners what Scouted Football is all about and what our listeners can do if they want to find out more about some of the youth prospects that you guys are talking about?
Yeah, so our main gig is writing out a newsletter over on Substack, covering heaps of stuff. We've got player profiles, youth tournament coverage, podcasts, long form, more conceptual pieces, roundup newsletters every week on little tidbits that are happening in the world of youth football and player development. So yeah, you can find us there on scoutednotebook.com or just the usual on Twitter at scoutedftbl.
Yeah, and on top of that, if you want to find out what Stephen and Clu are saying, Stephen is at Stephen Scouted on Twitter, now known as X, and Clu is at FFWTBOLLEW. I don't even know how to say that, so I'm just going to spell it out. But guys, thank you so much both for coming on. It's been great to hear about what's going on in youth football and get a little bit of a sense of your expertise on how you think youth football is moving forward into the 21st century. But thank you again both for coming on.